Chapter 12 is the middle of the book of Revelation. And it divides the book conveniently into two. And chapter 12 is also the start of the fourth vision in the book. The book is divided into seven visions. And in the first half of Revelation, there are three visions. And in the second half, there are four visions. Now, what we've been studying so far is the first three visions in the book of Revelation. First of all, chapters 1 to 3, the letters to the seven churches, then the message of the book sealed with seven seals, and the third vision, the trumpets of judgment. And the second half of Revelation is occupied by four further visions, and so chapter 12 stands right in the middle of the book. And from now onwards, until the end of the book of Revelation, we encounter emblematic characters, symbolic personages, and characters and beings. And these symbols are symbols of the persons who rise up in opposition to Jesus Christ and his church. Now, we read of the first of these characters this evening, the great red dragon. The dragon who sits permanently in front of the woman, waiting for the birth of the Christ life, so that he can devour the Christ life as soon as the Christ is born. The great red dragon. Later on in chapter 13, if you care to turn over just quickly, we'll see that there's a second emblematic beast, the beast from the sea, chapter 13 and verse 1. And we'll have to make something of him next week. And I saw a beast rising out of the sea. Now, the word sea there is the Greek word abussos, abyssos, which is the abyss. And it's the abyss of humanity. It is the sea of mankind. And at the end of chapter 12, you'll notice it says right at the very end of chapter 12, and he stood on the sand of the sea. Well, perhaps the better reading is, and I stood on the sand of the sea. And John is standing on the seashore, and he's looking into the ocean of mankind, and he sees coming out of mankind beasts, dictators and tyrants and dreadful men who set themselves up in opposition to God and to his Christ. Chapter 13 and verse 1. And I saw a beast rising out of the sea with 10 horns and 7 heads with 10 diadems upon its horns and a blasphemous name upon its head. And he goes on to describe the power of this monster. And the beast that I saw was like a leopard. Its feet were like a bear's, and its mouth was like a lion's mouth. And to it the dragon gave his power. Now you see, they're not the same beast. The dragon, the great red dragon that we meet in chapter 12, is over the beast. And the beast that comes out of the sea is only a tool of the great red dragon, because he's the kingpin of the whole story. And to it the dragon gave his power and his throne, my, and great authority. One of its heads seemed to have a mortal wound, but its mortal wound was healed. You see, the devil can rise from the dead. And the whole earth followed the beast with wonder. Men worshipped the dragon. This is coming. This is coming on the earth. Have you not thought it ominous the way that nations are linking up into, I'll have to use this word because I can't think of another one, amphictyones. You know what that is? Groups of nations heading up together in government. The United States was originally a collection of independent states, but it's now the United States. Russia was originally a collection of separate kingdoms ruling themselves, but it is now the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. You have the Warsaw Pact countries. You have the United Arab Republic. You have China. You've got the color red moving east, from the east to the west. Pretty soon Thailand will go, I'm sure. And I wouldn't be surprised if India went communist. Not in the slightest. Have you not thought it ominous that power now seems to be heading up into the hands of a few men? This is coming. And why shouldn't these superpowers unite to form one world government under the control of one man? Verse 4. Men worshipped the dragon, for he had given his authority to the beast, and they worshipped the beast, saying, "Who is like the beast, and who can fight against it?" So that's the next emblematic person. The next emblematic person, you see, they occupy the rest of Revelation, is Babylon the Great in chapter 17 and verse 1. Various ways in which you can understand Babylon. You can understand it as a kind of super church, a kind of false Christian church. And that wouldn't surprise me, because we are heading for the day of the super church. You see, what will it be called? A Euro church? We've got Euro cheese now, and Euro beer, and Euro bread, and Euro sugar. These are common names, you see, in the common market. And all the food will taste the same and look the same. So why shouldn't we have a Euro church? And if the common market merges with someone else, why won't we have a world church, a super church, the mother of harlots? Why not? Chapter 17 and verse 1. These things are coming. Then one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and said to me, "Come and I will show you the judgment of the great harlot who is seated upon many waters." You see, this is the devil's alternative to the bride of Christ. Does Jesus have a bride, the Christian church? Well, the devil has a wife too. It's the false church, the anti-Christian church, the mother of harlots. Verse 2, "With whom the kings of the earth have committed fornication, and with the wine of whose fornication the dwellers on earth have become drunk." And he carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness, a wilderness. And I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast, a red beast again, you see, which was full of blasphemous names, and it had seven heads and ten horns. The woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet, queenly attire, and bedecked with golden jewels. How unlike the bride of Christ. The bride of Christ is chaste and dressed in white robes, pure and clean, a virgin for the Lord. But look at this trollop here in verse 14. Look at this baggage who sets herself up as a living church. The woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet, and bedecked with golden jewels and pearls. What a vulgar creature! Isn't there a virtue in simplicity? Holding in her hand a golden cup, full of abominations and the impurities of her fornication. And on her forehead was written a name of mystery: Babylon the Great, mother of harlots and of earth's abominations. And I saw the woman drunk with the blood of the saints and the martyrs of Jesus, the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. When I saw her, I marveled greatly. And so these are some of the emblematic personages who occupy the book of Revelation from chapter 12 to the end. And in fact, the rest of Revelation is concerned with the judgment of God upon these beings who set themselves up in opposition to God and His Christ and His Church. And one of the real differences between the first 11 chapters of Revelation and from 12 to the end is this: that generally speaking, the first half of this book is about things on earth. The letters to the seven churches are churches on earth. This is what church history is going to be about. It's going to be a time of revival and decline. Some churches will be cold, some will be hot, some will be neither cold nor hot. Some churches will be completely indifferent to Jesus Christ. Now John says in the first vision, the letters to the seven churches, this is what history is going to be like on earth. In the second vision, the book of destiny is the book of history. And he says, this is what human history is going to be like. Then follow the seven trumpets of judgment. And he says, this is what it's going to be like when God blows his trumpets and sounds out his judgments amongst men. And by and large, the first half of this book is about this world. But from now on, everything changes. And it's as though God said to John, now look, sonny, I want you to put on these spectacles. You remember the days when they tried three-dimensional films? They didn't really catch on. But as you went into the cinema, you had to wear a little pair of cardboard spectacles with special colored lenses. And unless you wore the special spectacles, you couldn't make sense of the film. If you took the spectacles off, the film was just nonsense. It was just a riot of blues and greens. But if you wore the spectacles, suddenly the whole drama before you became three-dimensional. And you had some very alarming experiences. You had a railway train charging down on top of you in three dimension, and you could hear the people screaming, and you could actually watch the audience in the cinema leaning back as the railway train careered down on top of them. A great experience, but without the spectacles, meaningless. Now, history, without the special spectacles, is meaningless. It's a two-dimensional affair. It's just length and breadth, but no depth. And from 12 onwards, God says, now, John, I want you to see the real meaning of history. I want you to see the backcloth of history. And I want you to see tonight that if you are a Christian, this is the backcloth to your experience of Jesus Christ and salvation. War in heaven. In a sense, history consists of three persons: the woman, the child, and the red dragon. And if you understand this, you understand your experience of Jesus Christ and all your travails and your struggles as a Christian. If you can really grasp this, that there are only three people in history: the woman, the child, and the dragon. The Church of Jesus Christ, the Christ, and the devil. And all history is the history of the abrasion between these three characters. These three characters rubbing off against each other. The Christian church is in travail until Jesus Christ is born into the hearts of men and waiting to devour Jesus Christ is the dragon. And so you see, your final conflict as a Christian is never you against your old nature. It's never you against your old man, your old Adam, the old you. It's never you against your own flesh and blood. It's never you struggling against your own evil desires and sins and passions. It's Christ versus the Antichrist. Sorry to put it so simply. If you think that that's primitive, if you think this is too naive an understanding of Christian experience, then you just don't understand the Bible. It's Christ against the Antichrist. Now the marvelous thing about this vision, I don't want to dismay you, is that it opens with the opening of God's ark in heaven. Now there were three things inside God's ark, and you'll need these three things in the battle between Christ and Antichrist. First of all, there was a bowl of manna, food. You can't fight without food. Secondly, there were the Ten Commandments on two slabs of stone. They were kept inside the Ark of the Covenant. You can't fight without righteousness. And thirdly, there was Aaron's rod that miraculously budded overnight. A piece of stick that Aaron stuck into the ground, and the following morning it had sprung to life and there were leaves on it. You cannot fight without Christ's resurrection power, because that's the meaning of the inside of the Ark of the Covenant. The manna, the law, and the rod that budded. Food, righteousness, and the resurrection power of Jesus Christ. And in the battle of Christ with Antichrist, and the dragon with the woman and her seed, this is what you will need. Now I know that there are various layers of understanding of the woman. I need hardly tell you that the Roman Catholics think it's the Virgin Mary, with stars round her head and the moon under her feet and clothed with the sun and all that. But the woman is two persons, really. Israel in the Old Testament, struggling to bring forth the Messiah into the world. And all the trouble that the Jews had in the Old Testament was really due to satanic attack. We'll be studying later on, if we've time to look up a scripture or two, Satan's attack upon the Jews at every strategic point in her history was his attempt to prevent the birth of the Christ child into the world. He attacked the seed royal. That's the Old Testament. But this flows over into the New Testament, and every attack upon the Christian church and every attack upon a Christian is the red dragon's attempt to prevent the birth of Christ into the world, because the Christian church in the world is a church that is great with child, travailing until Jesus Christ is born in men's hearts and life. This is why it's so difficult to get people to come to Christ. And forgive me being blunt. This is why it's such a struggle for me to bring some of you to the birth in Christ. Some of you have been coming to church for years and you're not born into Christ yet. Because as soon as I travail in Christ, the dragon waits to snatch away the Christ life. And if he doesn't prevent the birth of Christ in people's hearts, then once they become Christians, he sits by them and he pounces on them and he prevents their consecration or their sanctification or their commitment or something of the sort. This is why it's so difficult to get Christians to move and make progress and grow up to be mature, balanced, healthy, fruit-bearing Christians. Because as soon as the life of Christ springs to life, the dragon waits to pounce. And so take a broad view of the woman. Israel travailing with the Messiah. And the Christ travailing until Jesus Christ is born into men. Now the real understanding of history then is war in heaven. It's a spiritual thing. You've got to put on the magic spectacles, otherwise you don't see it. And if you don't see it, your Christian life will be a hopeless struggle. And you winna get out the bet. It'll be a kind of 50-50 struggle. And you'll make no progress at all. Because you're wearing the wrong spectacles and you're living in a two-dimensional Christian existence. A tax upon the seed royal. And I could spend a whole evening alone going through the scriptures, Old and New Testaments, and at strategic points, picking out how the dragon sat waiting to pounce and did pounce on selected individuals. That's the meaning of Cain's murdering Abel, because Abel was the seed royal. And when Abel was killed, God had to provide another seed, Seth, another brother, and he became the seed royal. But Cain, as his history shows, Cain was an agent of the dragon. You find the same thing in Genesis chapter 6. Where the daughters of men became corrupted by evil powers. And you can see the gradual attack upon the royal seed, the seed that was to lead to the Messiah. It was the same with Abraham and Sarah. And Abraham tried to bypass God's promise and went to Hagar. And then you had the child Ishmael. Another attempt, you see, by the dragon to attack the seed royal and prevent the birth of Jesus Christ in the world. Why do you think Saul tried to kill David? Hurling a javelin at him in the tent. David was very friendly disposed towards Saul. David used to play his harp and charm him and charm the evil spirits out of him. Why therefore did Saul try to nail him to the wall? Read the story. He became demon-possessed. It's Saul, not just mad, not just bad, but demonic against the seed royal. Why did that magnificent witch, Queen Athaliah, try to wipe out every person in the royal house with the blood of David in his veins? Anybody who had the blood of David had to be killed. It's the dragon waiting for the Christ life. Do you see this? Let's read that story. The story of Athaliah in 2 Kings. Chapter 11. What a story.
You know, if she weren't so wicked, I think she would have made a magnificent minister's wife, Queen Athaliah. She had character, and she had drive, and she saw the vision that she wanted. Admittedly, it was all perverted and crooked and twisted. But my, she had drive. She would have organized things, I tell you, and led everyone a merry dance. Unfortunately, she was on the wrong side. 2 Kings 11. Now when Athaliah, the mother of Ahaziah, saw that her son was dead and she was left alone, she arose and destroyed all the royal family. Anyone with Davidic blood. Now you say that's just ordinary history. Not at all, not at all. Because if the line dies, the Messiah isn't born, preventing the birth of Christ. But see what happens. Jehosheba, the daughter of King Joram, sister of Ahaziah, took Joash, the son of Ahaziah, and stole him away from amongst the king's sons who were about to be slain. What a precious child that must have been. Because in that wee baby, there was the seed of Christ. That was the blood that was to come down to the Virgin Mary and Joseph and the Christ child. What a story. She put him and his nurse in a bedchamber. Thus she hid him from Athaliah, the wicked queen, the witch, so that he was not slain. And he remained with her 6 years, hidden in the house of the Lord. Interesting, he turned out to be a good king when he came to power, while Athaliah reigned over the land. But in the 7th year, Jehoiada sent and brought the captains of the Karaites and of the guards, and had them come to him in the house of the Lord. And he made a covenant with them, and put them under oath in the house of the Lord, and he showed them the king's son. And nobody knew he was alive. Can you not see the soldiers' faces as this wee baby boy is trotted out in God's house, and the guard says, "This is the king." Wonderful. So exciting. Verse 5. And he commanded them, "This is the thing that you shall do. One third of you, those who come off duty on the Sabbath and guard the king's house, another third being at the gate Sur, and a third at the gate behind the guards, shall guard the palace where the queen is. And the two divisions of you which come on duty in force on the Sabbath and guard the house of the Lord shall surround the king, this baby boy, each with his weapons in his hand, and whoever approaches the ranks is to be slain. Guard this boy. Royal blood. The seed royal, guard him. Be with the king when he goes out and when he comes in. Don't you leave him, because she'll kill him, the witch." The captains did according to all that Jehoiada the priest commanded, and each brought his men who were to go off duty on the Sabbath with those who were to come on duty on the Sabbath, and came to Jehoiada the priest. And the priest delivered to the captains the spears and shields that had been King David's. Significant. Get out King David's armor, which were in the house of the Lord. And the guards stood, every man with his weapons in his hand, from the south side of the house to the north side of the house. You speak about coup d'etats. Takeover bids by soldiers. That's what it is. It's as old as the hills, not new.
around the altar and the house. Then he brought out the king's son. Wonderful. He brought out the king's son, the progenitor of Christ, the ancestor of Jesus, put the crown upon him and gave him the testimony, and they proclaimed him king and anointed him, and they clapped their hands and said, "Long live the king!" When Athaliah heard the noise of the guard and of the people, what a Jezebel she was! She went into the house of the Lord to the people, and when she looked, there was the king standing by the pillar. And she thought he was dead. According to the custom, and the captains and the trumpeters beside the king, and all the people of the land rejoicing and blowing trumpets, and Athaliah rent her clothes, magnificent, and cried, "Treason, treason!" But nobody was taken in with that. Then Jehoiada the priest commanded the captains who were set over the house, "Bring her out between the ranks and slay with the sword anyone who follows her." For the priest said, "Let her not be slain in the house of the Lord." So they laid hands on her, and she went through the horse's entrance to the king's house. There she was slain. Verse 20. So all the people of the land rejoiced, and the city was quiet after Athaliah had been slain with the sword at the king's house. Verse 12, well, 21 really. Jehoash, as he was 7 years old, just a boy. And yet the progenitor of Christ. In the 7th year of Jehu, Jehoash began to reign, and he reigned 40 years in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Zibiah of Beersheba. Jehoash did what was right in the eyes of the Lord all his days. What a story. The dragon, the woman, the child, that's history. Josiah, oh, I wish there was time. There's no time, you see. We're past the hour. King Josiah, the godliest king who ever lived. Pharaoh was scooting up the Palestinian coast to attack the king of Assyria. He wasn't interested in Judah. Judah was small fry. He had no interest whatsoever in Jerusalem. And then in an act of madness, the godliest king who ever lived scooted across the country and intercepted Pharaoh and was slain. Why? Who put it into Josiah's heart to tackle Pharaoh? Was it God? It was satanic. It was a satanic attack on a godly king, and he came home to Jerusalem in blood. Oh, what a story. The book of Esther. That's what the book of Esther's about. Haman, Satan's agent, against Mordecai and Esther, and in that wonderful book, the name of God isn't mentioned. It was so risky and so dangerous to speak about God in those days. And how Haman set out to exterminate the whole Jewish nation, every man jack amongst them, every one of them, so that he would kill the life that was to lead to Jesus Christ. What a story. And the name of God isn't mentioned once. Herod, the massacre of the innocents. Why did he kill all the babies? Because he wanted the Christ life. Why did men try to get Jesus to drink drugs on the cross?
so that he would die half asleep. So that he wouldn't die of his own free will. So that he would die drugged. And so not be able to save you. And that's the real meaning of Satan's challenging you at every strategic point in your Christian life. It's the woman, the child, and the dragon. It's the dragon against the Christ life. And if he can't prevent the birth of Christ in your life, and if Christ is born in your life, then he certainly will prevent the growth of that Christ life. You understand that? A lot of Christians don't. It's not preached nowadays. It's not preached in some of the best churches. Some of the evangelical churches throughout our land that would claim to be Bible preaching and Bible believing churches, they just do not preach this. And why don't they preach it? You see, they don't preach it because it's the dragon against the Christ. The dragon against the baby. You grasp it? John says that the attacks that come upon you in your Christian life are floods from the dragon's mouth. Where are we? The end of the chapter. Where are we? 15. The serpent poured water. It's amusing. Like a river out of his mouth after the woman, to sweep her away with a flood, tries to drown the church. But the earth came to the help of the woman. Don't understand what that means. I think it means that the universe is on the side of righteousness, really. And for the everlasting right, the silent stars are strong. The universe is on the side of God. But the earth came to the help of the woman. Look at this. And the earth opened its mouth and swallowed the river which the dragon had poured from his mouth. Floods. Floods, floods, floods from the dragon trying to destroy you. And I have here a quotation from the book of Solomon, Song of Solomon. Many waters cannot quench love. Neither can the floods drown it. It doesn't matter how much water he releases against you as a Christian, trying to drown you and extinguish the life of Christ. Many waters cannot quench love. Neither can the floods drown it, because the death of Jesus has ensured that the floods never have the last word against the church of Jesus Christ. Listen to me, Christian. Jesus Christ walked on the floods. If there are floods and storms in your life, he allows them. Jesus walked on the floods, and in his death, he silenced them forever. You know what he said to the waves in the gospel story? Well, the authorized version says, "Peace, be still." That's too polite. The Greek word is shut up. It's the word that's used of muzzling a dog. And what he really said to the waves was, "Be muzzled." He walked on them. He silenced them in his life and in his death. And he invites you to join him. Amen. May God bless the preaching of his word.